This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, after a quick congratulations to Crunchbase News on their $30 million Series C, we discuss Google's acquisition of Fitbit and what it may mean as they compete more directly with Apple in the wearable space, and we discuss what Leafly's new capital and hiring freeze may be signaling about the future of the cannabis industry. The show was recorded on November 2nd. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
So I know when call recorder's on today. Wow.
Yeah, well,
that's like a great benefit for me.
Yeah, I figured I'd give you a little bit of a head start there, Graham.
Wow. Nice.
So I've had a very productive afternoon. I slept.
Tell me more about this.
I slept. So I took a nap.
You're not normally a napper.
No, I'm not. I'm not. But I did not get a good night's sleep last night. Yeah. And anyway, so I woke up this morning and I did some laundry. I got a load of dishes in, and then I spent about 45 minutes playing this fun little video game called Untitled Goose Game. Which I'm sure many people in our extremely vast and wonderful listening audience will have heard of. But Graham, are you familiar?
I'm not. Tell me about it.
All right. So I'm not a big video gamer these days. The games that I tend to like are pretty casual. And Untitled Goose Game is the perfect casual game. As the name of the game might suggest, you play as a goose that causes trouble in what seems to be a relatively calm and well put together little English town, and you know, all sorts of chaos ensues. Mostly pretty harmless fun. I got to take a farmer's rake or a gardener's rake and take it into a lake.
You took the lake and the rake.
Well,
rake in the lake.
I got to scare a small child into one of those quaint red phone booths. Let's see what else I did. Yeah, just general causing chaos. And then it's real, you know, the controls are really simple. You get to like pick stuff up. You can flap your wings around. And then I think the best part of it is you just get to, there's also a button where you can honk like a goose.
Ah, oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So I caused a bunch of chaos. Goose chaos. Yes, indeed. Goose chaos. And it's a lot of fun. Highly recommend the game. It's produced by what's the studio? House, which I believe is based in Australia. But don't quote me on that. Anyways, Graham, we have some stuff that we're going to be talking about today. I suppose first and foremost, we should say a little bit about who we are.
That's a great idea.
Sure, I can start. Hey, everybody. My name is Jason Rowley. I am a venture capital data journalist for Crunchbase News, where I write articles and munch and crunch Crunchbase data to make charts and graphs for both myself and other members of the Crunchbase News team. And then when I'm not doing that as a volunteer, I do some startup outreach work for the Python Software Foundation, giving free booth space at PyCon US to early stage startups that use Python in new and interesting ways. And then last thing I'll plug, self-promotional plug, is I have a newsletter, which you can subscribe to at my last name, Rowley.report. Graham, who are you?
Yeah, my name is Graham Peck. I'm a venture partner with Cultivation Capital. Cultivation is a Midwest early stage investor that invests in ag tech, life sciences, and software or IT technologies. I specifically work on that group, the software and IT technology side. And in addition to that, I work with a company called Brightgrove that's located in Ukraine and Belarus, and we help startups and larger companies build out their technology teams. So that's nice. What I do.
Nice. So, Graham, we have a couple of we have a couple of main topics that we're going to be discussing today, and as well as a very small side topic to lead off. Crunchbase has gone out and raised a little bit of money.
Oh, that's right. Congratulations to your employer.
Congratulations to my employer. Yes. Hopefully we're able to deploy it in such a way that continues the company's pretty rapid growth as of late. I don't feel like I'm at liberty to discuss much more than that.
Don't think you should, but that's no. Exciting to see Crunchbase doing so well.
Yeah. Yeah.
They raised, what, $30 million in a, what series was that? Series C?
Yeah, C as in cat. So Crunchbase raised $30 million in its Series C round, led by Graham. I've read the name many, many times. I do not know whether it is pronounced Omers or O-M-E-R-S Ventures, but it is the venture investment arm of the Ontario something municipal. It's a pension fund based in Ontario, and they led the round, and it had participation from Crunchbase's previous lead and participating investors as well. So
awesome.
Yeah. Things
seem again. Congratulations, and hopefully that means even more exciting things for you and your team at work.
That's fingers crossed, man. Graham, so we have two topics today. One I feel like we're going to spend more time on than the other. What I think we'll probably end up leading off with is a discussion of Google's acquisition of Fitbit, which went through at the end of, or at least was announced toward the end of the week, even though it was rumored starting earlier in the week. And then we are also going to be discussing kind of as a follow-up to a previous discussion that we had about the cannabis industry and some questions about how quickly it might be growing, or at least certain facets of that industry might be growing, based on some stuff that we found and wrote about over at Crunchbase News. So, Graham, what do you want to lead off a little bit with what happened with Google and Fitbit?
Yeah, absolutely. So Google announced towards the end of the week that they intend to acquire Fitbit. It sounds like that deal won't actually happen until probably sometime next year. You know, a lot of people, I think, were comparing the way this deal might happen in a few stages or phases to the way that their acquisition of Nest happened. Google announced that it will acquire it at, I believe, $7.35 per share, which would put a value on the whole business of Fitbit at about $2.1 billion. That's down dramatically from their all-time high stock price in August of 2015 of $51.50, you know, lower than their stock market kind of IPO of $30.40. So those are kind of some of the technical stats. I think that's an exciting thing. And, you know, what made me excited for us to cover this and talk about it was, you know, what does this kind of mean for, well, really for both companies, but in particular, what does this mean for Google's long-term kind of competition, I think, with Apple moving forward? And does this signal any kind of difference, you know, for them in the wearable space? Google has not produced its own wearable, even though it has a system that it calls Wear OS. That is a version that of Android, I think, that can be used for various wearable devices. And so, you know, obviously they'll be acquiring somebody who is a direct device manufacturer. And so it'll be interesting to see how this long term impacts their strategy of possibly competing with Apple and the iWatch. One other, I think, thing that I thought was interesting to note is that they had purchased about $40 million worth of intellectual property from Fossil in the wearable space earlier this year, and so some people are saying that it's very likely that maybe they even had some early indications internally that this or something like this was on the table for them, even when they worked on that deal. So those are kind of some of my thoughts to kick it off.
Yeah. So the a corollary related acquisition in Google's more recent past that might be comparable to the deal that they made with Fitbit is when Google acquired an intellectual property portfolio as well as the design team from HTC, the mobile device maker, which Google ended up parlaying some of that intellectual property, a lot of that design talent, into designing and ultimately manufacturing and shipping its Google Pixel phones. So it seems like Google is in the market for M&A in the name of building out its device making capabilities. The one thing that I am curious to see is how Google will try to reposition Fitbit as a serious competitor to the Apple Watch, and which is really the primary mobile health tracking and wrist mounted computing platform sort of today, to make Fitbit more competitive. And the reason I bring this up is, Graham, I found this very, very fascinating chart up on Statista, which is, for those who are not familiar, Statista is it's a company that aggregates charts and data and makes them available on a subscription basis. But anyway, so this chart from Statista has shows it's the market share of wearable unit shipments worldwide by vendor from Q1 2014 to Q1 2019. And in Q1 2014, so for reference, 5 years ago, Fitbit was responsible for 44.7% of all device shipments, wearable device shipments, again in Q1 14. In Q1 2019, however, Fitbit's market share has shrunk down to 5.9% of the total device shipments, and Apple has sort of grown to encompass 25.8% of total device shipments. So, I don't know. It's going to be it'll be definitely an uphill battle for Fitbit and Google if they want to make Fitbit a viable competitor at the kind of scale that the market sort of might demand right now.
You know, and one of the things that I think this brings up, obviously, is like Google Glass, and while the Pixel has been a phenomenal phone for Google and all of my friends who use it, I don't, but seem to rave about it. Google seems like they fall flat when they try hardware plays in general. Other than that, and again, Google Glass being one of kind of the seemingly most famously shut down projects of theirs. I don't know if you have thoughts on that. You know, one of the things that I have heard because of an early stage augmented reality startup that I've had some discussions with is that that it sounds like Apple will early to middle of next year launch a augmented reality glasses based product themselves, and I think has already begun to incorporate with iOS 13 a lot of the technology necessary into the devices that we all are carrying around right now to support there being some other, you know, type of AR VR experience that they can provide. So I don't know, does this have any comparison to Google Glass or their kind of failed efforts there in your opinion?
In my opinion, I think that's sort of an apples and oranges sort of comparison, because like at least in the case of Fitbit, we're talking about a company that has been in the market for years and years, has a established brand name, and you know, and did, you know, in no small part, you know, help to create the category of fitness focused wearables that Google, I guess, is now trying to buy itself into. You know, as compared to Google Glass, which was, I think, by Google's own admission and its own framing, was this, you know, brand new technology, right? So its early adopter program was called the Google Glass Explorer program. And Graham, we have friends that were part of that program as well. But it's just really interesting to see that that Google's making this move right now. But yeah, I don't see the exact comparison between its acquisition of a existing wearables company and its somewhat short-lived attempt to launch a consumer-focused version of its Google Glass platform, which, since we mentioned it, I'll just note that although Google Glass sort of failed to gain any serious adoption in the consumer side of the business, Google Glass and related augmented reality technologies have been able to achieve some significant traction in a more business to business sort of setting, surprisingly focused on manufacturing, in the manufacturing sector. But again, like, it seems that, like, with Google's acquisition of Fitbit, you know, they're really trying to get into the consumer health and fitness tracking business, you know, by way of an acquisition, and it sort of remains to be seen how successful they will be at it. But it is a clear complement to the hardware that they make on the phone side as well, you know, in an attempt for them to build their own little ecosystem akin to what Apple has built for itself with Apple Watch and the iPhones and all the rest.
You know, you bring up one of the things that I thought was really interesting and that was discussed in kind of all of the articles that I saw, and that was about Google's use of the health data on an ongoing basis.
Yeah.
Obviously there's probably some potential concerns if you put something on your body that likely knows where you are, how active you are, how your heart is functioning, at least to some extent. And, you know, that could have implications for medical data, insurance data, all kinds of things like that, and even advertising. And obviously, Google being an ad company, it'll be interesting to see. They claim that there's going to be no ad usage of this. It'll be interesting to see if that's true.
Yeah. I mean, not to make a potentially spurious comparison here, but at the same, you know, Facebook also said when they acquired Instagram and WhatsApp that it will be very difficult, nigh impossible, to incorporate the social graph of WhatsApp or the social graph of Instagram into the social graph of Facebook. You know, lo and behold, a couple of years later, they ended up merging everything together. So there is a non-zero chance that, that, you know, Google's Fitbit fitness data could be used in some sort of monetized fashion at some point in the future. Whether it's ads or whether it's something else, I don't know.
Show this ad only to people who average more than 8,000 steps a day, right?
Yeah, No. I mean, seriously, like, so I was reading through, this is not really relevant to Fitbit per se, but I've taken a slight interest in the world of the mattress industry, because there's 8 billion different direct-to-consumer mattress startups out there. And there was one company who I won't name that their mattress is internet connected, And you might be wondering to yourself, well, why is this an internet? Why do you have an internet connected mattress? And while on the surface, you know, it's, you know, you can say, oh, well, hey, it's for, you know, sending analytics about how well somebody sleeps to the company so that the company can then package that information and share it in some nice charts or data visualizations or whatever with its users to help them sleep better or whatever, right? But on the other hand, you know, the privacy, the terms of service and the privacy policy for this particular company also indicate that the company will have the ability to target ads based on its conclusions about whether or not somebody is, you know, sleeping well, whether or not they're sleeping with other people, et cetera, et cetera. And so, as soon as you get into the world of like biometrics, a whole new world, Graham, of privacy considerations need to be taken into account. And, you know, Google says it's been in its last keynotes. Sundar Pichai and others from Google have sort of doubled down on this privacy angle. It seems like that might be at odds with Google's business model historically.
Yeah, I think it will be interesting to see how that data ends up getting used. I don't know if Apple uses it at all today. Obviously Apple has, you know, made a big deal in some commercials about people with various different ailments or things, heart arrhythmias, as well as maybe even, I want to say I saw somebody who had some sort of liver or kidney problem, but that in some way, shape, or form, their Apple Watch had given them some alert that upon further checking it out with their medical, you know, team, discovered it was some sort of, again, like liver or kidney problem. And in any case, that part of it, in my opinion, I think is great that you can put a relatively small device on your wrist and it'll potentially tell you if you've got maybe not life threatening, but a serious health condition. And I would hope that, Fitbit is already doing some things like that. I'm sure Google will continue those efforts or maybe even strengthen them. But yeah, I guess in terms of sharing the data or using that data to either advertise to me or just in any other way, shape, or form is something that would make me relatively uncomfortable. Although, again, having the tool and the vehicle is handy because then if I want to look at that data myself or share it with a medical professional whose opinion I trust, there's a really easy vehicle right there on my wrist to do so. So I guess it's, you know, kind of mixed feelings like with a lot of things when you look at how the tech of today, you know, impacts or how commerce and technology live hopefully harmoniously, right?
Yeah. So, Graham, I have a question for you. Have you ever used Have you ever used a Fitbit?
I haven't ever used a Fitbit product. No. At least my dad does. He's regularly been a Fitbit user and has used mostly just their step counters, not anything like the Versa or that has any watch functionality. But my dad has, and I think my mom has been a casual Fitbit user, but I've only ever had the Apple Watch 3 for my health tracking, health and steps and all that.
Got it. I had one of those Fitbit. I forgot what they were called, but yeah, the little step counter thing. I kind of got into it for a little while, but this was like a long time ago. So anything that I say now would have been related to, you know, Fitbit as it existed, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. I just found the build quality to not be that great. The silicone wristband that it came with just totally borked out on me and ripped maybe 3 to 4 months into owning a Fitbit, and it was I don't know. It was like $10 or $20 to buy a new wristband, and I just never did. My Fitbit is living in the my sock drawer at I think it might be in my parents' house, but I don't know. You know, what I do find kind of neat about Fitbit, and what I wish Apple Watches were better at, is Fitbit's battery life is really good. And because, you know, they're not trying to do a lot of extra complicated computing on device. And accordingly, Fitbits are really good for tracking sleep. And as a man with issues with insomnia, my need for napping this afternoon is illustrative of those. I'm super, super interested in... I actually might end up picking up one of these things if Apple doesn't build better sleep tracking stuff into the Apple Watch.
So, are you where are the Apple Watch today?
It is currently sitting on a little. Oh, Graham, you're going to get a kick out of this. I have a little charging. Ooh. I have a little charging thing that makes it look like a like an original like 1984 Macintosh thing.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, this is the advantage of us being on Skype with video, and our users, obviously, or our listeners can't see that, but that's a cool
dingus there. Well, I'll put a link in the show notes. It's from a company called Elago, not a sponsor, but yeah, it's an adorable little Apple Watch charging stand.
So when you say that you got into the Fitbit when you used one before, yeah. By into it, do you mean that you think over time it actually impacted your number of steps and amount of exercise you got in total because of the tracking it was doing? It actually changed your behavior or made you shoot for 10,000 or some certain number of steps? Or when you say you got into it, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, this was around the time when like that, you know, oh, you got to get your 10,000 steps meme sort of popularized itself. And accordingly, I, you know, because I now had a way, an easy way to track my steps and not just track my steps on any individual day, but also track my, you know, track those trends over time. I was able to, you know, it sort of turned it into a little bit of a game. And accordingly, like in general, like I felt like I walked more, and was more mindful about, you know, being, you know, being something other than a total couch potato, which is my natural state, Graham, couch potato-dom. And so, yeah, I do feel like wearing a Fitbit, you know, for the time that I did wear it, did change my behavior quite a bit. And I see, you know, with wearing an Apple Watch today, you know, as dumb as it sounds to like, you know, oh, you got to close your rings or whatever. Like I'm not an avid, you know, oh my God, I have to close all my rings every single day sort of person. But, you know, again, if who said it? It's that saying of like, you know, you measure to you manage what you measure. Or something to that effect.
Yep. I don't know the exact phrase, but, yeah. But I know what you're talking about. And yeah, what you measure improves generally. I was just looking at some of my tracking data. And as I sit here, my Apple Watch died during the course of us starting to record this podcast. So nice. I need to put it on the charger. Nice. I didn't even know it was low. Must have alerted me that it was low while I was, in fact, taking a nap. But yeah, it looks like I take for the last year, I've taken an average of 9,054 steps a day.
Oh, look
I feel
at you.
I feel pretty solid about that. I mean, you know, shooting for 10,000, but I guess raising it 1,000 steps a day over a year, that's a lot of steps.
That's a lot of steps.
In any case.
So, yeah.
Well, cool.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to end up happening with this Fitbit deal. You know, it's Google is a weird company on this in this regard, because oftentimes it seems like it acquires a lot of companies, and then it's sort of where otherwise good teams and good companies go to die.
Yeah, I mean, in particular, it seems like they gather a lot of different technology, especially like through IPO or through gather IP through their acquisition strategy more often than they necessarily are really building stuff that ends up being great products out there in the marketplace, right? Like looking at Motorola and some of the other things like that. Again, maybe HTC acquisition eventually becoming what produces Pixel. Google Pixel, maybe aside in this case. But, you know, Motorola, which they acquired, I think stripped out most of the IP and eventually sold back off.
Mm-hmm. To Lenovo.
But pretty much decimated what was the company Motorola up until that point, right?
Yeah, totally. So, yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. It does seem that Google has slowed down its rate of acquisitions lately, mostly in the interest of taking much bigger bets on a few big deals as opposed to lots of tiny bets on a lot of deals. I'll just give a shout out to coverage by my colleague Marianne Acevedo, who wrote about Google's acquisition and corporate investment history following the Fitbit deal. And so just for some context there, at least according to Crunchbase data, Google has acquired 5 companies so far in 2019. And since we're, you know, at this point, mere weeks away from Thanksgiving, I'm pretty confident that there's probably not going to be any other major deals announced this year. But anyway, so 5 companies so far in 2019, as compared to an all-time high of 31 acquisitions in 2014.
Wow.
So, granted, most of those acquisitions in 2014 were on the software side. I don't have the full, you know, acquisition history in front of me at the moment. It's changing its strategy. And so while at the same time, Google is also really ramping up its direct corporate investments, and this is just investments as Google, not investments as other subsidiaries under Alphabet, like Google Ventures or Capital G. Just for context, Google itself has made 17 venture investments so far in 2019. As opposed to now using that 2014 number as a comparison against its relatively diminished appetite for M&A on the corporate investment side, Crunchbase data shows that Google only made 2 investments in 2014. It seems like they're pulling down on the lever of corporate investments and sort of taking the foot off the gas on M&A.
Obviously, one other, I guess, exception to kind of some of what I think we were just talking about of where good companies go to die or something like that is, I think, Nest, right? I mean, again, maybe some questions about about advertising and what happens with that data. But it seems like they continue to roll out a lot of new products within the Nest family.
I mean, also Nest is like hemorrhaging a lot of its original talent. Their head of Nest Labs their little corporate development arm, you know, that person left. I think Nest is also how to put this very diplomatically. Nest is an organization that is also in a state of transition, Graham.
Got it. I guess I should be careful. I have a Google Home Mini sitting just a few feet from me, so it's probably, you know, listening in.
Oh, sure.
And again, of course, we also publish our podcast to Google Podcasts, so, you know, I'm certain they've like somehow scraped and indexed every word we've ever said. But
oh, totally. I mean, it's
Google. Internet technology is great.
Yeah. Oh my God. Remember, Google is Skynet. So it'll all work out. Boy, Graham. Anything else on the Fitbit? I have one last thing, one last point to make, which is back to your original thing about the viability of Google's sort of long-term wearables play. And what I will only, I'll mention that, so folks like Ben Thompson over at Stratechery and other folks have long noted that Apple, despite shipping a minority share of the handset market, so of all of its iPhones, or of all mobile phones or smartphones, Apple ships a relatively small percentage of those. But Apple is also responsible or takes down a very large majority of all profits in the smartphone space. And so with that in mind, it'll be kind of curious to see. I'm curious to see what Google ends up whipping out to see whether or not it is able to not only gain market share from a absolute number of devices shipped, but also gain a market share from the perspective of aggregate revenue and profits in the wearable space. So who knows what'll happen on that front.
Yeah, and if you're saying that that the chart that we'll include the link to in the show notes, if you're saying that Fitbit is shipping one device, is shipping one device for every five Apple Watches, it'll be interesting, I guess, to watch that trending over time.
Yeah. Yes, it will be. So,
and if Google makes any impact on that,
for sure. Graham, do you want to talk about weed?
Yeah, let's talk about weed.
Weed, not a sponsor. Graham, there's all sorts of opportunities for making some real dank puns here. Oh, boy. The only dank puns I'm going to drop knowingly here is the opening line to an article I wrote for Crunchbase News. Headline is cannabis review site Leafly takes on debt following company-wide hiring freeze. Opening sentence is, it looks like Leafly is rolling up some green in a new round of funding, which is bound to spark a little reefer gladness at the cannabis strain guide, dispensary review, and e-commerce company. So in case you guys are not familiar, Leafly is it's a website. It's kind of like Yelp for cannabis dispensaries. They also sell in certain states. They sell cannabis and CBD enhanced products. And they also, I guess they got their start as a guide to the many, many different strains or types of cannabis available, sort of indexing their various primary and side effects, yada, yada. The company has grown really, really quickly. It was originally acquired by a private equity firm called Privateer Holdings. It was spun out once again as a independent entity this past February, and has under the leadership of a gentleman named, oh no, what's his name? Real-time follow-up, Graham. His name is, where is he? Where in my article is it? Oh, sorry. I should have probably had this in front of me already. Under the leadership of Tim Leslie, who was previously the head of global expansion at Amazon Prime Video, and he was previously at Amazon for the past 20 years, which is a mind-boggling amount of time to spend anywhere. Anyway, so the company has doubled its headcount since spinning out as its own independent entity until now, when the company's opted to freeze hiring for at least the rest of the year. It's ordered its employees to cancel or postpone all company-funded travel unless it is absolutely mission critical. And all the while, a SEC filing indicates that Leafly Holdings intends to raise as much as a $25 million in a combination of debt. It's probably, it doesn't say specifically what the financial instrument in question is, just that it's a debt and then, rights and options to acquire other types of securities at some point in the future. So it's probably a convertible note of some flavor or another. But anyways, Graham, I just wanted us to touch on this because it points to some potential growing pains in an industry that certainly had a lot of public and private market investors very excited.
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting topic. One thing I'll call out, or I guess two things that I'll call out quickly, are that, it's interesting to watch everything else in this space for folks listening to this. You can also check out the first episode of our podcast where we talk about Philo, which is a Chicago-based cannabis marketing compliance platform. We talk about one of their raises, especially as it kind of relates to or shows kind of larger Midwest investing dynamics. And then we also talk in our third episode about Vice investing as a whole, more about Juul. And again, we talk in depth about what each of our views are on whether something like Leafly falls under Vice. At least for me, it probably does, which means it's not a type of investment we would look closely at. All of that being said, it's been interesting to watch how valuations have just absolutely skyrocketed in this space. I know, Jason, you were saying as we kind of prepped for this episode that, even once marijuana, which seems like the inevitable conclusion today, even once marijuana is recreationally legal, which certain presidential candidates who are currently up for the job would like to see happen nationwide, possibly as soon as 2020 or 2021, even once that's the case, I think we're a long way off from it being as readily available as, let's say, alcohol, like beer or wine or, even harder spirits are. And so I wonder if capital has piled into the space and driven valuations up in a way that has made it too that have driven valuations too hard or excuse the pun, but too high in this space for the number of consumers that there are who are active and who are able to, through recreational and or medical use, able to take advantage of the space today.
Are you saying that the valuations are a little hazy, Graham?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So as we record today, I am able, if I wanted to, I can go downstairs and I can go sort of kitty corner to my building, to the 7-Eleven, and I could buy all of the booze I want, fairly easily if I wanted to at theoretically any time of the day, which is not the case. Certainly is not the case with cannabis, which is at least in Illinois, it's going to be. So Illinois is one of those states where cannabis is going to be legal starting January 1st of 2020. Ushering in a new level of elevated consciousness in a new decade, Graham. Very excited about that. But it's going to be limited to, a relatively small collection of dispensaries. And the state of Illinois has been a little slow to give out permits for business owners who want to either start their own dispensaries or start growing or processing cannabis or cannabis products. It's, in other words, Graham, it's not going to be a situation where you can just go to your corner store and say, excuse me, sir, or ma'am, all I want is some of your dankest nugs and a fat blunt to smoke upstairs. It's not going to be.
And of course, Doritos.
Well, I mean, you know, you gotta, yes, of course, you know, you got, you gotta have a, vertically oriented, product offering, in whatever retail location you go to. But yeah, so, you know, there's reason to doubt, you know, that the market for cannabis will be as giant as the alcohol business is, if not, you know, because of potential differences in demand and the need for changing consumer behavior and consumer preferences, but also just from the regulatory compliance side, that it's, you know, that this is something that has historically been illegal, and even if it is treated from a tax standpoint as alcohol is, I'm fairly willing to bet, Graham, that that the sort of puritanical bent of politicians around the U.S. Will sort of stymie the spread of an otherwise relatively harmless and if I do say so myself, relatively enjoyable plant product.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's interesting, like, as you're pointing out, even in Illinois, where it is medicinally legal today, and I think has been for years, and it will become recreationally legal on January 1st, so less than 2 months from now, you know, still in certain businesses or industries, since it's a federally, you know, still a Schedule I drug, it will not be be able to be consumed, I know, by people in at least a couple of industries. So, you know, that's one of the things that I think is interesting, is obviously looking at the differences in law when, you know, the federal government obviously makes it illegal, and a state then tries to kind of, you know, trump that with their own with their own legislation that supersedes that, even though obviously in a literal sense, that's not the way that it works. Yeah, I don't know. Access to it aside, are there other instances of companies that you have seen at Crunchbase where there are signs that maybe the market is a little ahead of where the consumer base is? I know one of the things pointed out in your article is that Weed Maps, which is Leafly's chief competitor, laid off about 25% of its workforce, or around 100 people, about 2 weeks ago.
Which is a lot of
people. Are there others that you know of in related spaces that are struggling to kind of continue to grow the way they thought the market would?
No private company. So first, I'm not an active reporter on the cannabis startup beat. So I personally have not been, made aware of any other, I guess growing pains, man, I'm running out of opportunities to make puns here, Graham.
Whoa.
Whoa. hits blunt. So, no, so I've not been aware of Jesus.
Wow.
This will never air, Graham.
Oh my. Oh, I thought what's in the show is in the show.
No, it's in the show, Graham. This is real. This is what's happening now. Where was I? Sorry. So
you were saying that you don't cover the kind of cannabis beat closely.
Sorry, I guess my joke about short-term memory loss was taken a little too seriously. But yeah, so I think what I think has been more interesting to watch has been public market reaction to cannabis stocks, to publicly traded cannabis companies, notably a lot of just comical amounts of volatility as investors are trying to sort of figure out how to value all this stuff. And I'll give a shout out to a gentleman named Max Cherney, who covers his whole beat is the cannabis industry for MarketWatch. If you're at all interested in following the The ups, the downs, and the sticky ickiness of the cannabis industry, at least from a public market standpoint. So,
you know, I mean, working for a fund called Cultivation Capital, yeah. I've been approached more than one time, and people have just assumed our logo also coincidentally is green, have assumed that we invest, if not chiefly, at least occasionally in the cannabis space. And that's not a space that we invest in at all. The firm was named in 2012, long before, you know, there was kind of this burgeoning marijuana investment space. But I've seen whole funds dedicated to marijuana investing, using kind of the venture model to invest in companies that are producing various products or even technologies around the space, have seen interesting pitches for point of sale systems and other things like that, that are adjacent or service providers to the space. Again, taking into account kind of all of the, I guess, heavily regulated nature of the space and the reporting requirements.
But
so,
but that's like, that's exactly what, you know, venture capital is for. Right. It's for making bets on companies in emerging industries and emerging sectors and taking those risks and hopefully, you know, being able to generate an outsized return from, you know, whatever proceeds ultimately redound from those, you know, from those investments. But again, you know, one of the things that is predicated on, you know, this, the venture capital model succeeding is rapid growth of the industry. And that's why, you know, these layoffs, at least at more peripheral companies in the space, you know, because Leafly is a certainly a, I guess you'd call it a destination website. It is a sort of media-ish company. It is a e-commerce-ish company, but it itself is not growing, you know, or producing products of its own. But anyways, you know, it's still operating in this space that investors have for a long time thought was, if you'll forgive the pun, growing like a weed. And now it looks like for the same sort of regulatory hurdles and consumer preference stuff that has sort of been lurking in the background for a long time, that certain realities around those two issues are bringing that those expectations of just how quickly or just how big this market will get in the very short term, you know, into question. So, yeah, it's Graham. You seem like you're chomping at the bit. What do you got to say?
No, I was not.
Okay, well,
it's just interesting to watch the space, and it'll be yeah, I think interesting to see how pervasive it becomes as it become, you know, as the rollout continues, in my opinion.
For sure. Yeah. So I don't really have anything else to bring up on the cannabis front. Graham, do you want to, do you have anything else, or do you want to wrap this one up?
No, I think this is a good time to say it's maybe no longer the show.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for listening, everybody, and we'll see you when we see you next. I'm gonna go hit call recorder. One, two. No longer the show.